I want to talk about cultural studies in dark times, using Hannah Arendt's phrase, in part because I think cultural studies is always about being in dark times, and in part because I think the times are getting darker all the time. And I want to point to four questions, four conversations that I think are necessary if cultural studies is to move forward and find ways of intervening with interesting things to say and useful things to say about these dark times. I do not mean to suggest that these are the only four questions that need to be raised, but they are the ones that strike me and that concern me. One question is pragmatic, if you will, and that is about the project of cultural studies itself. What is the practice that defines the specificity of cultural studies so that one can move across different problematics, different empirical issues, and still say, I'm doing cultural studies, right? So that one can say, for example, my work is on gender or feminism, but I do it from a cultural studies perspective. Not all feminist work is cultural studies, but I think there is feminist cultural studies. I would say the same thing about work on race, gender, sexuality, coloniality, post-coloniality. Cultural studies is not equivalent to any of those fields, does not occupy and define them, but it does intersect them so that one can say, I do cultural studies around the question of post-coloniality or sexuality or gender or race or their intersections. And I'm going to spend the most time, since I'm opening, I feel it responsible at least to put on the table that question. What do we mean by cultural studies? I do not mean to speak with anything other than the authority of having for 45 years tried to figure out what the answer to that question is. And I'm interested in hearing other people disagree, agree, veer off. I offer it not authoritatively, but pragmatically. The second question is conceptual, and it involves the question of a conjuncture, which, as you'll see, I think is crucial to cultural studies. The third question is philosophical, and it involves the new ontology, and at least one perspective, one body of work within what is sometimes referred to as the new materialism. And the final question is empirical in the sense that, partly coming out of the previous question, I think cultural studies has to do more work studying the empirical multiplicities of culture itself, right? And the different ways in which culture is both actualized and effective in the contemporary conjuncture. Okay. Having said that, let me launch into a rather arrogant statement for me, my statement of what I mean when I talk about cultural studies and why I have pursued it for 45 years as a distinctive intellectual practice, as a distinctive way of doing political intellectual work. I do not mean to say it's the only way, it's the only valid way, it's the only useful way, but I think it has some distinctiveness and some utility that is not captured by other perspectives on the political and cultural problematics of our times. So I will kind of list, if you will, a number of elements of this practice or project. The first is, I think, that cultural studies is defined by a dialectic of political passion and intellectual rigor. It cannot sacrifice either one to the other. I think both of those tendencies to to give in to your political passion and think that that defines sufficient academic work, or to devote oneself to intellectual rigor at the cost of one's political passion. I think it holds it together. Moreover, I think it holds it together in what I would describe as an unexpected directionality. That is, it starts with pessimism of the intellect. I think most, at least in the United States, people think it's pessimism of the will, optimism of the intellect. And I think for cultural studies, it's pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. That is, that you have to dig so deep into how bad the world is, intellectually, with great rigor, in order to try to find a way out to recover some sense of possibility. Right? Not to start with the sense of possibility, but to work the other way. Secondly, and perhaps most obviously and banal, that with great banality, it takes culture seriously. It takes culture seriously in its political analysis and calculations, which is not to say that cultural studies is about culture or that it's about the politics of culture, as you'll see. I'm going to try to make that clear. And I think those two elements, for some people, define cultural studies. And for me, it's not sufficient, partly because it does not distinguish cultural studies from a wide range of other critical perspectives. So the third thing is, like much of Euro-modern thought, it believes that the world is understood and can only be understood in terms of relationality, which is inflected in a particular version of what is often called constructionism in cultural studies. That particular version says that relations that make up reality are both contingent and real. Again, I think there are positions that see the contingency of relationships and therefore dismiss their reality. And there are positions that see the reality of relations and dismiss their contingency. Cultural studies, I think, holds on to both, and is that problem is encapsulated for some of us in the concept or the term articulation, which defines not a theory, and I think this is a mistake I have made in the past, but a problematic, right? The demand to study the forms, modalities, practices, and mechanisms of relationality that constitute the world. But still, I think that's not enough. And so the fourth commitment, fourth element of cultural studies I want to point to, is what I have often called radical contextuality. Right? Cultural studies is, I said, not about culture, it is about contexts. It refuses, I think, to define itself by some disciplinary object, including culture, but instead sees contexts as unstable, changing sites of struggle. Right? Not as rigid, fixed historical objects, but as open, porous sites of contestation to construct reality. And therefore, and this I will come back to, it sees both political commitment and theoretical commitments as always contextually defined, as strategic responses to particular contexts. This is a point I want to come and emphasize, and that is, for me, again, cultural studies is not about having a theory and understanding the world with that theory. It's about trying to understand a context and finding the theoretical and political tools one needs to make sense of what's going on in the world or in that particular context. And that is partly for me an expression of what I take to be the cultural studies critique of European Enlightenment and European modernist thought, which is fundamental to cultural studies, which is a radical anti-universalism. right? And it, the radical contextuality leads to one of the most common, I think, caveats and practices of cultural studies. And I'll talk Stuart Hall in his description of how he approaches Gramsci and took up Gramsci's work gives a, I think, wonderful description. But of course, I think Stuart always gives wonderful descriptions. He says that one must delicately disinter, right, to remove, delicately disinter ideas, concepts, etc., from their concrete and specific historical embeddedness and transplant them into a new social context with considerable care. So Stuart's Gramsci wasn't Gramsci, it wasn't a debate about is this what Gramsci said or meant or is this the best way to read Gramsci? It was how can we take Gramsci's ideas formed in response to one context and gently lift them up and plant them in new soil so that they will grow in a different way, right, in order to help us better understand the contemporary context. So, radical contextuality. Is this enough? Not for me. Right? Because with radical contextuality, I think cultural studies brings with it a commitment to complexity. Right? Cultural studies is a practice of thinking with and through complexity and is therefore radically anti-reductionist. Right? Now, in a way, if contextualism denies that everything can be analyzed in the same terms, right, anti-reductionism denies that anything can be analyzed in simple, singular terms. Nothing. Contextualism says you can't assume that what worked in one context works in another. Anti-reductionism says that you can't ever assume that something can be explained simply as about A. It's always about A and B and C and D. And cultural studies, it seems to me, is committed to that sense of complexity, to the refusal to say, in the end, it's about whatever, gender, race, sexuality, coloniality, class, etc. And the combination of contextuality and complexity, it seems to me, defines the specific political and epistemic tone of cultural studies, which David Scott, in a beautiful essay on the ethics of Stuart Hall, describes lovingly as a tone of always provisionality. Right, of uncertainty, of open-endedness and incompleteness. You always have to be willing to say, as Stuart Hall once said, that today I think this is right, but the odds are 50-50 that tomorrow I won't. Right? Either because I've left something out or because, you know, new theoretical tools bring something to light, etc. It is a kind of humility and provisionality, which I must admit I'm not very good at embodying. But other of my colleagues and friends in cultural studies are very good at it. In that sense, cultural studies is a kind of constant experimentation, not only intellectually but socially. Exploring forms of collaboration and a kind of meta interdisciplinarity. What I mean by that is, Stuart has a passage in which he describes it. It's not about bringing sociology together with literary criticism, two disciplines coming together. It's about making sociology an interdisciplinary formation in its own right, and literary studies an interdisciplinary formation in its own right, and then bringing those interdisciplinary formations into a kind of meta interdisciplinary formation. Right? So it's more complex as an interdisciplinary experimentation, and therefore, again, has to be humble and provisional, and seek what Paul Gilroy calls convivial forms of relationships, of intellectual and political work. Seeking what I'll come back to always, forms of unity and difference. Not forms of unity and not forms of fragmentation and difference, but forms of articulation, of creating new kinds of relationalities, unity and difference, both politically and intellectual. Is this enough for cultural studies? Not quite. Almost for me. And it may be my own background and education in cultural studies, but I want to add one more term, and that is, not surprisingly, what Stewart calls attending to the discipline of the conjuncture. Cultural studies is conjunctural. In the first instance, as a particular level of abstraction, right? And we might distinguish, although I think this is an oversimplification, between political work on what we might call the event, you know, the election in England, a horrible, right? We might study the election as a particular event, although it's probably too depressing for the moment for anyone to study, right? Or the United States circus, we call an election, right? On the other hand, we might study epochs, right? We might study what used to be called the longue durée. Foucault is perhaps the best exemplar of a radical contextualist who works at the level of epochs, right? So that discipline, right, extends over centuries. Biopolitics extends over centuries. These are not new phenomena, although they're articulations might change in context. Right? Cultural studies works at a level of abstraction in between, right? Defining, I think, an effective site for political intervention aimed at changing the tides of social change, and as a propitious, useful level at which intellectual and political analysis can converge. Again, I don't want to deny the importance and utility of the other levels, and there are probably more, right, that one can identify, but I want to suggest that cultural studies chooses strategically, intellectually, and politically to operate at a particular level. The concept of conjuncture, as I'm sure many of you know, has a long history in which it has taken on very different meanings. And it comes into cultural studies largely through Stuart Hall's rereading of Gramsci into the contemporary context, in which it's not merely a level of abstraction, but the terrain on which a struggle, to use Gramsci's phrase, over a new reality is carried out. Right? It marks the emergence of what Gramsci called an organic crisis, constituted by the articulation of multiple crises. Right? And I want to say a word about that. Right? The complexity of the conjuncture, right, has to be taken seriously in its multiple forms. Right? So first and most commonly, people, Hall and others, have talked about the complexity of the conjuncture in terms of the complexity of forces or determinations, or if you want to use Althusserian phrase, the different levels. That is, an organic crisis, and hence the conjuncture, is defined by the fact that there are crises operating not only in the economy, but in politics, culture, social relations, etc., etc., but recognizing that each of these levels that I've just named, and there may be others, is itself multiple. So there isn't just one crisis of the economy today. Right? Neoliberalism too often suggests that there's a kind of unity operating at the level of the economy, rather than understanding that the economy is itself a multiply contested terrain, and there are struggles between real estate and finance and manufacturing, et cetera, at each of these levels, economic, political, et cetera. And each of these levels is multiple as well in terms of temporalities and spatialities. Different struggles have different temporal reaches and histories and different spatial reaches and histories. But it also, the complexity of the organic crisis and of the conjuncture, I think, refers as well to the complexity or multiplicity, if you want to use the au courant phrase, of political articulations, right? Of the sites at which these various crises come together into concrete political struggles. And here I'm thinking of, you know, the terms within which we all think of politics, economics, which isn't necessarily class, but there are economic articulations of these crises, which are defined not merely in economic terms, but at the intersection of economic, political, social, and cultural struggles in all their complexity. But class, race, gender, sexuality, nationality, coloniality, all of these are sites of articulation, it seems to me, of the complexity of the organic crisis, which is understood as a way conjuncturally. And of course, all these sites, in cultural studies terms, have to be related to one another as well. So that as sites of articulation, race is itself, in its complexity, is itself articulated to gender, sexuality, class, etc., etc. Right? Verging on the chaotic, but always struggling to find order in the chaos. Right? And all of these complexities and struggles, of course, are lived out themselves in a variety of ways, socially, institutionally, or structurally, if you will, and phenomenologically, or psychologically, if you will. So we can think of race and struggles around race at a phenomenological level of how people approach it, which might be understood partly through ideology, but also in structural terms and in terms of social relations, et cetera, et cetera. Hence, cultural studies, for cultural studies, conjuncturalism puts forth the problematic in very explicit terms of constructing and understanding unities in difference in this complexity. Hence, there is a kind of conjoining of these two concepts. And I'm not a Gramsci expert, so I'm not going to say in Gramsci, although I think it's there, at least it's readable. But in cultural studies, there is a conjoining of an organic crisis and the concept of a conjuncture. In fact, I want to suggest, and I'm just testing this idea out, that cultural studies emerges out of and in response to the existence of an organic crisis. And therefore, cultural studies is itself a conjunctural strategy, not a universal strategy. Right? One has to be able to imagine cultural studies disappearing. If one can imagine a world that is not constituted as by an organic crisis, Gramsci certainly thought there were moments without organic crisis. Part of the problem is we've all grown up in a world that seems to just be going from one configuration of the organic crisis to another. But cultural studies, it seems to me, has to accept the possibility of its own irrelevance. Right? It cannot claim, for me, to be a universal strategy, a universal critical practice. One can't know, or at least I can't, what might follow it. I mean, if we ever get out of this organic crisis. Now, the second question I said I wanted to raise, I'm just going to point to because I'm hoping that my brother, John, is going to talk about this. And that is, despite what I've just said, the concept of a conjuncture is, I think, under-theorized as a conjunctural concept. And there are people, and John and Janet amongst them, I think, who have done great work, Doreen Massey, Paul Gilroy, and others, who have done great work trying to think through the conjuncture in its spatial complexity. You know, it was convenient when the great work out of England on Thatcherism was done to think of the conjuncture in national terms, as a national formation. When I wrote some of my work on the United States, it was convenient to take a national formation. And in Gramsci, it certainly is. But I think that doesn't work so well anymore. But I don't know how to get beyond that, how to rethink it. Doesn't mean the national formation is irrelevant, but it means we need to understand the complexities of spatial determinations in politics today and how that might lead us to redefine, reconceptualize conjunctures. Similarly for the temporality of conjunctures. And similarly for what I might call the political stakes of the conjuncture. I take it as a given for cultural studies that the politics of cultural studies in its conjunctural form are always a politics of democracy, of a certain understanding of democracy, which is linked very closely to an understanding of the popular. I find it ironic, in the United States at least, that so much progressive politics, which speaks in the name of democracy, is really basically willing to ignore two-thirds of the, or more, of the U.S. population, as if, you know, they're bad already, they're conservative, or they're liberals, and we don't really need to address them, instead of needing to move them, which it seems to me is what cultural studies is about. And moreover, it's a politics, I think, that implies that we have to think about the unity and difference amongst political strategies, struggles over the state formation, forms of autonomous activism, forms of artistic activism, and forms of what Chantal Mouffe called new social movements. Right? But these have to be somehow articulated together. And one of the failures, I think, of the U.S. left is precisely the failure to do that, so that each of these sets of strategies becomes so assured in its own right that it's the proper way to move forward, that it can't form an effective and viable transformative force in the United States. I'm hopeful John will take these up. In fact, I sort of know he will, and I'm sure others will, speaking about global issues. There is something paradoxical about cultural studies. It's both a massive success in that it seems to be everywhere and a massive failure. My friend Mikko Leitinen from Finland has written a paper in which he says, if cultural studies is all about conjuncturalism, then why is it so rare to actually find any conjunctural studies these days? Right? And I think that's a crucial question, which I can't answer. But I think I can say very quickly what stands in its place, what cultural studies becomes, you know, in which, especially, again, in the United States, there is a kind of decontextualizing of a particular formation or model or concept from cultural studies beyond the context in which it was developed as a strategic, intellectual, and political strategy. And so, you know, I still get papers to the Journal of Cultural Studies which do some cultural analysis and claim it's by definition cultural studies or encoding, decoding, or any one of a number of strategies which have been developed as ways of trying to do conjunctural analysis in a particular moment, which then become decontextualized and universalized. Doesn't mean subcultural analysis or encoding, decoding isn't still relevant, but one, I think, has to think about how it's articulated as the context and the conjuncture have changed. I think the sense of context becomes extraordinarily weak in much work. And you can always tell this because the context is either in the first or the last chapter, right? Rather than being present throughout the whole thing, because every term, every practice, every element is itself contextually constituted. You know, here's what you need to know about France in the 21st century, and now we go on. Or here's what you know. Or now that I've given you a reading of French television, let me in the last chapter tell you about the context. Right? Rather than understanding that all of these programs are themselves historically, contextually constituted. So context is the whole thing, right? So that retreat away from a conjuncture into a weak sense of context. There is certainly in the United States a return to disciplines and to the authority of disciplines. Raymond Williams talked about this long ago by saying, you know, there is the project of cultural studies, and there is its formations, media studies, urban studies, etc. And what may often happen is that people in those formations get so hung up on legitimating their formation in the academy that they forget the project of cultural studies. Right? And finally, I think, and this is what I'm going to turn to next, is in the United States, at least, theory has often replaced cultural studies. More and more people seem to think that if you read Deleuze, you don't have to do any empirical work. Right? That all the answers are given in advance because you know the theory is right. And as I suggested, I find that troubling as a way of doing it. So I want to turn to theory for a moment. And I want to offer a second image. I use the image of disinterring a concept from one soil into another. But there's a second image that Stuart Hall loved, that I particularly love, and that is that cultural studies proceeds and advances by wrestling with the angels. Wrestling with the angels. I love that image. Right? Because it suggests a kind of convivial antagonism. Right? Not that one succumbs to the other side, to the angel, or that one defeats the angel, but that one converses, recognizing and exploring the differences in order to move forward. And it seems to me that cultural studies has always moved that way. It wrestled with humanism, it wrestled with structuralism, it wrestled with post-structuralism, it wrestled with postmodernism. In each case, it came out saying, we're not structuralists, but we learn from it. We're not post-structuralists, but we learn from it. And we're not postmodernists, but we learn from it. Right? In each case, Stuart Hall used to say, you know, the position as a theoretical position has insight, but it goes too far. It absolutizes, it universalizes the insight of the position. Right? So it's not a search for the right theory. Right? I mean, that, I think, is one of the differences between what one might call theory and philosophy. Philosophy is an endless Hegelian progression in search of the right theory. Right, so, you know, Spinoza goes to Deleuze, to Whitehead, and we go on, searching for the right theory, right philosophy. Cultural studies is looking for the useful theory and looking to these kinds of philosophical arguments for tools that will enable it to advance. In the contemporary world, because cultural studies is always about understanding the world better so that one can understand, one can open up possibilities for struggle and intervention. Right? In that sense, you know, it is critical, in the Marxist sense as well, of not accepting the taken-for-granted terms of the existing reality for what it is. So, just a quick aside, so much of what's being written about the economy in terms of risk, circulation, so many of the descriptions of finance capital I find disturbing from the left, because they basically buy the terms that finance people use, right? This is exactly what Marx's critique of political economy was, right? That you take for granted the terms of the existing economic strata, existing economic formation, and then think you can use them against itself, as opposed to rethinking, going beyond those, critiquing those, to find better descriptions. And I want to suggest that that's happening today. That if theories are always a response to and an expression of their context, one has to think about the different ways theories express and respond to their context. And I find some of the leading theoretical or philosophical work today, translated into theory, problematic. And I want to talk about this in terms of the new ontology. And I'll be very brief, because I'm hoping that this will be a discussion. Now, I want to make clear that when I talk about this, I'm only talking about a subset. This is a formation which, fortunately or unfortunately, tends to ignore its own history, right? Tends to ignore the ways in which it is linked to Frankfurt critical theory or to debates in post-war France over Heidegger, et cetera, and tends to forget that Deleuze's sodomizing of Spinoza, which is what he describes it as, you know, that suddenly becomes an authoritative reading of Spinoza. You know, so that one of the people who most vociferously defended the Enlightenment suddenly becomes the leading figure in an anti-Enlightenment term. Right? It makes sense in the context of concerns, in post-war France about fascism and about the way in which Heidegger's sense attempt to rethink the Enlightenment or to think beyond the Enlightenment rejects the one, the unity, in the name of fascism, right? There are lots of terms circulating around this new turn in philosophy. The new ontology, the new materialism, speculative realism, anti-representational theory, post-humanism, etc. Now, I want to be clear here. I don't mean that all ontological work, I'm not talking about all the ontological work, I'm not talking about all the post-humanistic work, right? I'm talking about a specific part of the larger assemblage of attempts to think beyond what's really Kantian reductions of relationality to the singular form of Kantian mediation. Right? So I find some post-humanist work very crucial and important. Some, not anti, but post-representational work crucial and important. I find some of the new materialism crucial and important. But I think that there are also versions of it that have to be, from a cultural studies perspective, challenged. As I've already suggested, this work emerges largely from French and Italian appropriations of a number of seriously committed Enlightenment scholars, Spinoza and Leibniz in particular, and turns them into anti-Enlightenment. Deleuze, at least, as I said, has the courage to say that he's sodomizing these philosophers, and not offering anything that would be responsible reading of, I don't know what the opposite of sodomizing is, offering. Respectful. Celibate. And then they combine that with a number of truly counter or anti-Enlightenment philosophers, such as Bergson and Nietzsche and William James and Whitehead and Simondon and others. And combine that in turn with a very peculiar, but this may be an expression of my age and generation, return to the authority of science. Right? And return to physics, mathematics, certain developments in biology, etc. Ignoring, by the way, Foucault's critique of science, right? Which wasn't about the content of science. It's not that Foucault was saying, oh God, Newtonian physics is bad. He was saying the practice of science is an exclusionary practice, and it still is. You know, that is to say, it denies the legitimacy of other forms of knowledge production, right? And excludes all sorts of things, including, in most cases, the work that we do. You know, I had one, a friend of mine wrote a paper, and he said, oh, what we need to do is start conversing with the scientists. To which the response was, have you ever tried? They have no interest whatsoever in conversing with us, right? I mean, they're kind of amused that we might be citing their work in chaos theory or, you know, complexity theory, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't want to share their grant money with us, you know, and they don't want to hear that actually we've been talking about complexity much longer than they have, right? So this odd turn to science, especially the first and second laws of thermodynamics, which then give rise to quantum theory and relativist theory. This approach, the approach I want to criticize, right, the subset of this assemblage of valuable work critiquing, I think, the Kantian foundations, Paul Ricoeur, Paul Ricoeur said, we are all neo-Kantians. Right? I think he was right up until a certain moment when, in fact, Kant is called into question as the foundations of the possibility of modern philosophy. Right? What I want to question is that assumption underlying some of these developments that essentially the Enlightenment can be defined by its dualistic thinking. And in particular, a set of, really, I think, three fundamental dualities, which are then taken as equivalent. Nature versus culture, objectivity versus subjectivity, reality, as it were, versus language. Representational theory. Right? It is this which gives rise to a kind of materialism that I think is reductionist. Everything becomes materialist, but now with an understanding of materialism, not in terms of fixed, isolated, and reified bodies, but in terms of pre- and post-individual capacities or affordances, which are then assembled, but always temporarily and always as an act of power, into heterogeneous assemblages. Right? Hence, you find a materialism which is framed by figures of becoming, vibrations, rhythms, intensities, etc. And a materialism which, to a large extent, eliminates the need for mediation. Right? Not just the Kantian version of mediation, but even the Deleuzean-Guattarian notion of mediation by which effects are always on the way to producing other effects. Right? Now, what happens is actually that these philosophies don't reject dualism because they end up constructing a new dualism in which that previous term, the term which in the previous Enlightenment, Kantian formation, was privileged, the human, the subjective, language, now becomes subordinated to the new privilege term, which is reality, objectivity, and nature. All of the first terms can now be explained as simply manifestations of this second term. Right? So as I said, there's a kind of reductionism, What it ignores is precisely what I think Deleuze and Guattari argue when they write together in their more political work, and what the pragmatists understood, which is that reality can be processual, but how those processes actualize and are manifested operates in different ways at different levels of reality. Right? So you could have, as Deleuze and Guattari do, fundamental processes, but those processes, when you describe the level of crystal or the level of the inorganic or the level of the organic life or the level of the human, have to be understood as radically distinct. Right? And therefore, non-reductionist. You can't reduce one level to the previous levels. Right? So that while it is true that human life is composed materially and that it is composed biologically, it does not deny the specificity of the human and the ways in which language, discourse, whatever you want to call it, intervenes into the construction of a human reality, which is partly biological, partly material, but also more. Right. It is to avoid what the pragmatists call the reductionist fallacy. Right. The result is that, in fact, a series of ironies and paradoxes emerge. And I'm, as I said, sliding through these. What starts, I think, as a reasonable critique of the universalist pretensions of, for example, humanism and of representation, ends up rejecting the reality of humanism and representation. Right? And as Stuart Hall, again, once said, one can be an anti-humanist theoretically, but you damn well not better be an anti-humanist if you're trying to mobilize people into a political revolution. One has to look at those complex articulations. What starts as an attempt to affirm the human as composed both materially and biologically ends up apparently denying that there's more at stake in the human. What starts off as a reasonable critique of the paranoid tendencies in certain practices of critique ends up rejecting the very possibility of discovering what's going on. And here I'm thinking of a wide range of essays. Latour's has critique run out of steam. Rancière has written this. Michael Hart, Negri and Hart have written this, in which a politics of composition or love or something replaces, in the end, any need for a better understanding of what's going on. In which case, I want to say to them, why are you getting paid as academics? Because I can practice composition and love, and many of my friends do, and they're starving artists, and they're starving activists. They don't have the luxury of paid intellectual labor, although more and more of my friends don't have the luxury of paid intellectual labor either. But that's a different story. Right. So that a philosophical project that starts with complexity and the constancy of change ends up locating itself in terms of a simple rupture between the old and the new. Now, this is true of a lot of the work, for example, not all again, but a lot of the work around biopolitics. Ignoring the fact that Foucault argued that biopolitics emerged in the 18th century and has been continuous through that. A philosophical project that emerged in large part in response to fascism as the absolute power of the claim or demand of unity, of the one, continues to speak with the same presumption that unity and the one are somehow fascistic, even at a time, at the same time arguing that the problematic of power today is not the assertion of unity, but power that operates precisely through multiplicity, dispersion, fragmentation, and heterogeneity. A theory that critiques the Enlightenment for its universalist pretensions ends up as a new ontology offering a universalist philosophy of all existence. Right? A philosophy that it ends up with a philosophy that can find no way towards a politics other than in its own philosophical terms. It is, I think, the realization, actually, of a very old European dream amongst philosophers, which is that philosophy itself is politics. Right? So that doing philosophy is a political act in and of itself. And I'll just say, you know, we can argue about this, but I don't believe that. Right? And it is, as well, a philosophy, it seems to me, that ignores its own groundedness in the contemporary situation, so that it lacks a kind of self-reflexivity. But again, I don't want to reject these developments to court. I want to say that there is a conversation to be had that moves us forward, because such developments raise questions about the efficacy and importance of the non-human and about the changing nature of the human in the contemporary conjuncture. It raises questions about the historically changing forms and loci of agency. It raises questions about the technologies of articulation and the production of relations. It raises questions about the nature and organization of contemporary power. And finally, and most importantly, I think, it raises questions about the multiplicity of effects that constitute the reality of human existence, although it goes too far and erases the specificity of the human, erases the multiplicities of mediations, and underplays the complexity of relations between the material, the biological, and the discursive. And this leads me, and I'll stop after this, to be very brief, this leads me to the question of culture, right? Which I think has to be an empirical question. Right? How does culture function conjuncturally? And I want to suggest that we need to begin to think of culture. Discourse, if you will, is a perhaps better term, since culture is so heavily laden with Enlightenment and Kantian, post-Kantian connotations. But it needs to think about the multiplicity of forms of culture and of culture's effectivities. Not to deny representation, but to deny that it is all representation. Not to deny signification and consciousness, but to deny that it is all and only signification and consciousness. This was, it seems to me, Foucault's great argument in the notion of discursive formations, that discursive formations have multiple effects, only one of which, for example, was about meaning or about subjectivity. There are multiplicities of effects, and I think there are multiplicities of formations of cultures which have multiplicities of kinds of effects. And some of you will know that I've spent a long time writing about some subset of those effects that are not primarily signifying or representational, but forms of what is, fall under the umbrella of affect. Again, one of the tendencies of this work that I'm critiquing is to render affect into a singular, immediate version, form of effectivity. So in one famous example, Brian Massumi might argue that the color codes of the security in airport have some immediate effect on the body of the individual. Asocial, acognitive, aconscious, and adiscursive. And I want to say that's idiocy. I'm sorry. That's just stupid. Color codes are decidedly discursive, social. They may be habitual. I think what's missing is an adequate theory of habit by which effects get produced without the mediation of consciousness, not because signification, consciousness, etc., is not involved, but because it's habituated. Right? And one misses what is in parenthesis, what one doesn't have to go through every time, because these become embodied habits. Right? It's like a classic phenomenological study of piano playing, David Sudnow's The Ways of the Hands. Right? A pianist is habituated to play the piano. They don't think about it. But this isn't purely materialist. This isn't asocial, adiscursive, etc., etc. This is a complex habituation of social, cognitive, mediated forms of discursive practice. Right. So if one thinks, and John, I haven't run this by John and others, but if one thinks about the work on Thatcher that's so famous in British cultural studies, Policing in the Crisis, and Forward, I mean, they argued that culture worked in part ideologically, although that ideologically work, John has argued, I think brilliantly, was largely within the ruling bloc. How do you hold the ruling bloc together despite its contradictions, right? It talked about common sense, right? And I think common sense is a different cultural formation than ideology. And it has different effects and different logics and different mechanisms, right? But they didn't talk as much. They also raised the question of what they call TINA. There is no alternative. And I think they didn't address that question. Why? I mean, in a sense, Marx argued this is true of all ideologies. Every ideology that tries to naturalize itself. What's distinct about the contemporary world in which, you know, neoliberalism, marketization, financialization seem to present themselves? And I think the answer has to do with what I would call other forms of effects, affective effects, forms of investment, forms of feeling, what Raymond Williams calls structures of feeling. And what, in a recent article, wonderful article, Jeremy Gilbert calls disaffected consensus. But I actually think what are the things I argue in my new book is there are actually dozens of forms of consent. There's angry consent, there's hopeless consent, there's exuberant consent, there's disaffected consent. We need to understand that when we think people are consenting to the primacy of the market, to there is no alternative, we need to understand the multiplicity of feelings, of investments, of organizations of affect that are defining these. My friend from Colombia, Eduardo Restrepo, wrote an essay in which he said, the irony is that the least explored term in cultural studies is culture. Stuart Hall famously wrote, as director of the Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies for a long time, the invitations I feared most were those which expected me to explain what culture actually was. And I want to conclude by simply saying, we can't avoid the task anymore. Right? We have to take on the concept of culture, but we have to understand it as a multiplicity. We have to understand the complexity of discursive practices and effects that are operating in the world today. It is a conversation which I hope takes place. Thank you.